Part 4. Spies on Screen. 8. Espionage and the Cold War in DEFA films. Double agents in For Eyes Only and Chiffriert en Chef, Ausfall Nummer 5. Carol Ann Costabile-Hemming. The Cold War is typically defined as the political power struggle between the two nuclear superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States, from the end of World War II until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Both countries sought to gain territory and hence influence over other nations and convert those nations to their own political ideology, be it communist or capitalist. One of the most hotly contested territories was the geographic epicenter of Europe. The crossroads dividing the Warsaw Pact countries from the NATO nations, East and West Germany. Following the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany, FRG, and the German Democratic Republic, GDR, in May and October 1949, respectively, the two countries formed the border of the Iron Curtain. It should come as no surprise, then, that security agencies such as the CIA, the KGB, the West German Bundesnachrichtendienst, BND, Federal Intelligence Service, and the East German Ministerium für Staatssicherheit, MFS or Stasi, Ministry for State Security, found divided Germany to be fertile ground for surveillance and counterintelligence activities. Given their geopolitical role, the two nations, and most especially divided Berlin, also became natural settings for films about the Cold War, an appeal that has continued, as the success of Steven Spielberg's 2015 blockbuster film Bridge of Spies confirms. It is therefore also not surprising that espionage had high cinematic currency, given the dense concentration of spies in divided Berlin. The CIA, for instance, had some 8,000 agents stationed in Dahlem, a number that doubled following the June 17, 1953, uprising in the GDR. Though official information regarding the number of Soviet KGB officers is not readily available, one source indicates that there were some 350 staff officers in Karlshorst between 1947 and 1962. In this chapter, I focus on the spy film genre in the GDR, analyzing the representation of double agents in two East German films, For Eyes Only, Streng Geheim, and Chiffriert en Chef, Ausfall Nummer 5, Coded Message for the Boss. Produced by the state-owned film studio, the Deutsche Film Aktiengesellschaft, DEFA, both films depict the period shortly before the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961, a time of heightened tensions between East and West, one in which agents and double agents played a pivotal role. Using stereotypical portrayals of Western military and intelligence officials, and drawing on state-supported propaganda, both films present the West, in particular the United States, as a threat to the security of the GDR. By publicizing and politicizing this threat via feature films, the ruling Socialist Unity Party, SED, in the GDR, presented its populace with believable justifications for the construction of the Berlin Wall. Despite the 15 years that separate the film's premieres, both films stake out the construction of the Berlin Wall as a significant milestone in protecting the East German capital, not just as a barrier against the influence of Western provocateurs, but also as a pivotal tool in protecting the GDR from invasion by Western powers. For Eyes Only premiered on July 19, 1963, in the East Berlin Cosmos Theater. directed by Janos Vesey and a product of the Solidarity Artistic Production Group at DEFA, it was the most popular of DEFA's spy films. The main character, Hansen, is an agent employed by the Stasi to infiltrate the U.S. Military Intelligence Division, MID, in West Germany. While the Americans believe he is a defector, he actually is tasked by the GDR with stealing classified military intelligence documents from the United States that point to a NATO plot to invade the GDR. Set in July 1961, the film is loosely based on the theft of U.S. military documents by the Stasi agent Horst Hesse in 1956. Directed by Helmut Juba, Chiffriert an Chef, Ausfall Nummer 5, premiered on November 11, 1979, and is often compared to Four Eyes Only. The main character, electronic engineering student Wolf Brandin, is recruited by the CIA, specifically to decode messages from the GDR and the Soviets. He notifies the Stasi, and his interrogator and later supervisor, Werner, convinced of his loyalty to the GDR, encourages him to accept the CIA's offer, thus marking the beginning of his life as a double agent. In the end, Brandin double-crosses the CIA, preventing the West from learning about the East's plans to build the Berlin Wall. During the Cold War, both the East and the West used feature films as a medium especially suited to transmitting specific and stereotypical images of both allies and enemies. The images that the films conveyed corresponded closely to widely held beliefs among the viewers. The state intentionally created belief systems which feature films were then supposed to support and help maintain. According to historian Bernstöver, enemy portrayals in films are especially effective when they are compatible with established belief systems, corroborate and expand on existing information transmitted in other media, and simultaneously deliver proof of truth. Espionage films in particular play a unique role in substantiating these belief systems, for they operate within the simple binary of good versus evil and prey on audience emotions with themes of loyalty, betrayal, patriotism, and xenophobia. Sabine Hake describes the Cold War cinematic topography as one of demarcation, exclusion, and containment. The United States' position during the Cold War focused on a policy of liberation. The goal was to free the Eastern Bloc countries from the control of the Soviet Union. The GDR's leaders viewed this liberation policy as a constant threat to the GDR, and Cold War DEFA films played on these fears. By combining facts and truth with the characteristics of feature films, these Cold War-era films gained a documentary air, resulting in a high level of believability among viewers that the events were real, or at least plausible. To think of it in Hake's terms, the GDR espionage films were tasked with clearly marking the rival, while working to exclude and contain the enemy. Moreover, like James Bond films, these films take contemporary concerns into account, which makes their fictional world more believable. To this end, characterization is key. The East German spies' successes are portrayed as victories that, at least temporarily, appear to resolve political conflicts. Moreover, the reliance on exaggerated stereotypes typecasts the Western characters as unscrupulous and immoral, playing to widely held misperceptions of West Germans as Nazis and U.S. military forces as warmongers. In contrast, Stasi agents and the East German double agents appear as morally upright citizens whose espionage activity supports the GDR fledgling state. In both films, the double agents successfully foil the West's attempts to invade the GDR, and the agents are rewarded for their efforts with the restoration of a routine family life. One can argue that, much like James Bond films, these feature films portray a nationalist fantasy, whereby the sovereignty of the East German nation and its superior intelligence system are brought to the forefront. My analysis shows that For Eyes Only purposefully calls attention to a perceived real threat to the GDR from the West. Chiffriat en Chef looks back at the late 1950s and early 1960s, reminding viewers that threats from the West were deterred by the building of the wall. In both instances, the dramatization of these threats captivates audiences by appealing to their sense of fear, further rationalizing the importance and effectiveness of the Berlin Wall. Because the film appeared just 2 years after its construction, audiences watching For Eyes Only could leave the theater feeling secure that the wall would protect them, even though it is never directly mentioned. Premiering some 18 years after the construction of the wall, Chiffriat en Chef touts the wall as a success by looking back at the threats that were commonplace in the late 1950s and early 1960s. The film thus reminds audiences of the wall's ability to prevent attacks, which in turn means that audiences remain willing to accept its existence. It was intended to serve as propagandistic support for Leonid Brezhnev's recently announced peace initiative. The film focuses intently on character development, where Brandine is depicted not as a superhero but as an ordinary citizen willing to assume responsibility and protect his society. More than just nostalgia, the portrayal of Brandine's agent handler as benevolent depicts the Stasi in a positive light, deflecting the resentment of the people toward the Stasi, which had become further heightened following the expatriation of the controversial and dissident singer-songwriter Wolf Biermann in 1976. The agenda of East German espionage films was firmly rooted in the very mission of film in East German society. When DEFA was founded, Sergei Tulpanov, the director of the Propaganda Administration for the Soviet Military Administration in the Soviet-occupied zone, emphasized the important role the film studio was to play in the creation of a new socialist society. The DEFA film studio has to tackle important tasks. Film, as mass art, must be a sharp and powerful weapon against reaction and for the deeply developing democracy, against war and militarism, and for peace and amity among peoples of the world. Initially, in the immediate post-war years until 1949, DEFA films focused on a single enemy, the Nazi, as criminal. By 1950, the approach broadened to include the Western allies as villains. Kurt Metzig's Der Rat der Götter, Council of the Gods, 1950, based on material from the Nuremberg trials, was the first DEFA film to feature crass and negative portrayals of Americans, a trend that continued for many years thereafter. According to Hacke, anti-American portrayals were common in contemporary dramas that focused on the reorganization of public and private life, the changing relationship between work and leisure, the emergence of new forms of association and community, and the gradual transformation of cultural tastes and preferences in accordance with an emerging socialist culture. The SED tightly controlled film and print media, underscoring the media's role in legitimizing the messages that the government transmitted. Especially in the beginning, film and other media were supposed to convince, in other words, explain, the approved political direction of the time, deliver educated arguments to convince the masses, but also clearly define the enemy. The creation and perpetuation of the enemy image of the West was of primary importance and served as the central theme of the political propaganda depicted in early feature films. Not surprisingly, the Stasi was involved in every aspect of film production in the GDR. Dagmar Schittli describes the Stasi's influence as massive. On the one hand, in direct decision-making and thus preparing the party's cultural policy, and on the other, using unofficial operatives who took care of the flow of information and also interfered and helped determine procedures. As a result, very few productions dared to portray the Stasi on screen. For those films that did contain depictions of its agents, the Stasi worked together with DEFA openly in order to provide advice. Indeed, in the case of Four Eyes Only, the Stasi's press office sent a booklet titled Flight Through the Night, a factual report about the mysterious disappearance of two safes from the American Secret Service, which related the story of Horst Hesse's double-crossing of the United States. The best-known portrayal of the Stasi was the television series Das unsichtbare Visier, The Invisible Gunsight, which ran from 1973 until 1979. It was created by DEFA to counter the underground popularity of James Bond. The show's success is often attributed to the main character, Werner Bredebusch, played by Armin Müller-Stahl, until December 1976, when Müller-Stahl fell out of favor for signing the petition against Wolf Biermann's expatriation. The best-known filmic portrayals of the Stasi, Heiner Karo's Verfehlung, Transgression, 1991, and Frank Beyer's Der Verdacht, The Suspicion, 1991, were not made until after the fall of the wall and the end of the GDR, and represent some of the last films by DEFA, which was dissolved in 1992. Most portrayals of the Stasi in film and television focused exclusively on foreign espionage, a tactic designed to reinforce among the populace the need for an espionage organization. The focus on foreign threats represents a one-sided portrayal of the Stasi, for that perspective ignores the Stasi's extensive surveillance of its own citizens, most egregiously following the expatriation of Biermann. Reading Chiffriette en Chef in the context of the aftermath of this November 1976 decision, however, can be fruitful for understanding the perceptual divide that existed between ordinary citizens and the state security apparatus. Commonly referred to as the GDR's most famous spy movie, For Eyes Only is loosely based on real events from 1956, when the Stasi sent Horst Hesse and Hans Wachs, the real double agents, to infiltrate U.S. military installations, and they succeeded in stealing safes from the U.S. Military Intelligence Division in Würzburg in what was known as Aktion Schlag, Action Strike. The safes contained classified documents, the personnel files of 137 U.S. spies stationed in the GDR. Because of this information, the East Germans were able to arrest the Western agents, who were viewed as a danger to the country's stability. The East exploited the success of this mission as a means to document the domestic strength of the MFS and to promote the agency's value to the general public. The East German state viewed the capture of the agents as a major step toward thwarting the West's liberation attempts. For Eyes Only was produced 6 years after the Hesse incident. Thus, its debut occurred at a highly critical period of the Cold War, following the construction of the Berlin Wall, and a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, an event that was fresh in the minds of GDR audiences, particularly because, in October 1962, the SED initiated a nationwide propaganda campaign against the United States and its attempted overthrow of Fidel Castro. This was a time that Peter Ulrich Weiss describes as one in which the production of enemy stereotypes was running at full speed. The film particularly appeals to cultural functionaries for the way it exposes weaknesses within Western intelligence services. The Stasi spy, Hansen, is a hero who is willing to work for the good of socialist society, forsaking personal risk and even abandoning his son in the GDR. Though seemingly nondescript, he appears to have almost superhuman strength, a character like any other action figure. Rather than remaining true to the life story of Horst Hesse, Hansen's charge derives from the belief that there is a Western plot to overthrow the GDR. Due to the heightened tensions at this point in the Cold War, this feature film corroborated the idea that the West had sinister plans with regard to its Cold War rival. Thus, the plot of the film reminded people of the need for vigilance with regard to the enemy in general and specifically in relation to the recent construction of the wall. The believability of the film in part has to do with the very controlled way in which East Germany marketed the dangers of Western efforts to overthrow or liberate the GDR. Using scare tactics, such as reminders that the Cold War could turn hot at any moment, the Stasi managed to keep the dangers from the West constantly in the minds of GDR citizens. This was an active strategy designed, among other things, to create support for the construction of the Berlin Wall among the citizenry, at least psychologically, a logical objective given the context at the time. The film's production relies on the use of factual material and authentic documents, which contribute to the film's documentary feel. Situated within the highly charged context of the Cold War, media accounts leading up to the film's release reported on various plots by the West to overthrow the East German government, accompanied by witness testimony from former spies in the West who defected to the East. As Stöwe explains, For Eyes Only functions in the propaganda campaign as conclusive proof that the GDR narrowly avoided an attack in August 1961. Even the film's opening credits allude to the factual basis of the plot. The action of the film is fictional. Similarities to actual events and living persons are intentional. Secret Service advisors were on hand during filming to certify that the film conveyed a positive image of the agency. These advisors were able to influence the relationship between reality and fiction in the film, promoting fiction in order to make it believable. Further adding to the believability of the film, the dialogues among the actors portraying Americans were filmed in English and subsequently dubbed with voiceovers in German. The film has been described, mistakenly, as the GDR's answer to James Bond, primarily because it premiered 6 months after the West German debut of the first James Bond film. However, James Bond films were not available for viewing in the GDR, and the film had been already in production before Dr. No was released. DEFA dramaturg Dieter Wolf, who worked on the film, states that there is no evidence documenting a connection between the two films, and he emphasizes that the GDR actually was very proud of the fact that it had created a different type of spy hero. According to the Federal Agency for Civic Education, Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung, the film was a popular success. Within 3 months, more than 1 million GDR citizens had seen it. It was screened throughout Eastern Europe, especially in Poland and Romania. It was also a political success because it made the external threat to the GDR believable to audiences. The film contributed to a consolidation of the SED state in the 1960s. The opening sequences of the film immediately draw the audience into the milieu of espionage and counter-espionage as concerns about a mole in the U.S. Military Intelligence Division, led by Major Collins, are intercut with scenes of the Stasi discussing strategies to steal documents from the Americans that outline plans for an invasion of the GDR. The film begins with shots of Hansen in the woods near the German-German border and then cuts to his immediate supervisor, Collins's office, where he informs him that two West German spies have been captured. Collins is concerned about the sudden disappearance of seven Western agents in 14 days as they attempt to gain access to GDR telegraph offices. Hansen remains cool, though Collins is visibly alarmed, for he has been fooled by a double agent before. Before he departs for a meeting in Frankfurt, the camera pans his office and zooms in on a large safe without revealing its contents. While others are suspicious of Hansen, he is the only employee from the East and the only one without a Nazi background. Collins had handpicked him and is therefore confident in his loyalty. As a clear sign of his trust, Collins places Hansen in charge of Concordia Import-Export, the cover name for the MID office in Würzburg, while he travels to Frankfurt for a meeting at military headquarters. That meeting reveals that the plans for E-Day, the West's invasion of the GDR, are ready to be distributed. The camera closes in on the cover of a file labeled For Eyes Only. Thus, the film's English title is a wordplay on the security level of the plans. As the meeting concludes, Collins's superiors question him about the captured agents and the possibility of a mole in his office. While Collins denies the likelihood of a security breach, the commanding officer instructs Colonel Rock to investigate. It is not until Hansen travels to West Berlin with Collins that viewers become privy to his real name, Lorenz, and his role as an agent for the Stasi. Hansen slips out of his West German hotel room and crosses the border into East Berlin, evading the West German agents that Collins has instructed to watch him, despite Collins's supposed trust. He delivers information about MID to his Stasi superior, who then takes him to a high school swim meet, where Hansen is able to watch his son Manfred from a distance. Hansen's son believes that he has fled the GDR illegally. Though Hansen is clearly pained at not being able to speak to his son, he willingly sacrifices his personal life for the safety of his country. This characterization posits Hansen as a hero figure who loves his family, his home, and his homeland, and is willing to accept personal sacrifice in order to protect what he holds most dear. As a character, he is quite flat. Loyalty to the state comes at all costs, even abandoning his son. During this visit to East Berlin, Hansen is tasked with stealing the plans for the E-Day invasion. The East-West dichotomy is prominently personified in stark characterizations. Whereas Hansen is portrayed as a clean-cut, moral, and upstanding model citizen, his Western counterparts, particularly the Americans, are portrayed in common stereotypes as corrupt and immoral gangsters. Collins is unscrupulous, buying precious artworks to sell on the black market, engaging in extramarital affairs, and falsifying payments to undercover agents. The MID doctor is a drunkard who mistreats women. Conversely, Hansen's Stasi commander is portrayed as fatherly, treating his agents more like sons than subordinate operatives. Colonel Rock suspects Hansen is the MID mole, and only a loyalty test can convince him otherwise. When an East German worker, Wilhelm Hartmann, is captured in Nuremberg for making propagandistic speeches to groups of workers, Hansen is tasked with his interrogation. This is a pivotal scene in the film, for Collins knows that Hansen and Hartmann were acquainted before Hansen's defection. When MID agent Schuck is unable to coerce a confession from Hartmann, headquarters orders Hansen to Nuremberg to conduct the interrogation. After listening to the recorded interrogation, Rock becomes increasingly suspicious of Hansen. Though others think Hansen is trustworthy, Rock points out that Hansen is the only German at MID who is not from the Gestapo, the security service, or at least the SS. In order to put the issue to rest, Rock decides to have all MID employees undergo a lie detector test. The interrogation, supervised by the MID doctor and conducted personally by Rock, takes place in a basement, which, as Weiss suggests, is eerily reminiscent of a Gestapo interrogation. He argues further that the American characters are so plastic that they are completely interchangeable, for the film is not about the portrayal of a specific enemy, but rather the depiction of a preconceived image. The camera work in this scene is composed of a series of rapid close shots alternating between Rock and Hansen. Hansen remains calm, despite the psychological strain he experiences under Rock's rapid-fire questioning. Rock, on the other hand, sweats profusely, embodying the physical characteristics that one expects not from an interrogator, but rather from the one being questioned. During the interrogation, Hansen's own safe is searched. Agents discover photographs of MID agent Schuck and an unknown woman, later identified as Madame Adelheid, an agent for the West German Gehlen organization, the precursor to the West German Federal Intelligence Service. As it turns out, Schuck is a double agent working for Gehlen and tasked with obtaining copies of the MID's plans. When Rock learns the woman's identity, he and Collins return to the MID office, where they find Schuck in the process of copying documents. Rock and the doctor drive Schuck to the woods and turn him over to Madame Adelheid. Schuck is shot and his body disposed of in the Wannsee Lake. Schuck's discovery diverts attention away from Hansen, for all believe that the mole has been found and eliminated. The following weekend, Hansen again is left alone at the Würzburg headquarters. He loads a safe into the car and heads for the German-German border. In a spectacular showdown with West German border patrols, which shoot out his tires and his windshield, Hansen crashes through the border and transports the secret documents safely across. The East Germans publish the documents, thus foiling the West's plans to invade the GDR. Given Hansen's upstanding character and loyalty to the GDR, it is no surprise that his mission is successful. Indeed, because of the documented success of Hess's earlier escapade, made public in the documentary portrait Disco Film 5, the feature film seems to draw on a factual basis, making it believable. Unlike a James Bond film, which closes with the hero in bed with a woman, For Eyes Only stresses family values. In the closing sequence, Hansen's Stasi superior drops him off at his son's school, where the two are reunited. This happy ending with family points to a type of domestication of espionage, something not typical of Western spy films and a theme that is repeated in Chiffriert en Chef. This final scene underscores the Stasi characters as positive, moral, and clean living. Hansen exudes Puritan qualities that prevent him from succumbing to Western extravagances. He remains true to his principles. The portrayals of the West are convincing, even though no filming took place there, and despite the temptations offered in the West, life in the East is both honest and staid. The primary objective of the film was to support the belief widely held by East German leaders that the West had been planning to invade the GDR. Indeed, the original sketch was intended to warn GDR citizens about the tactics of Western agents, in the hope that they would report any unusual situations to the proper authorities. Thus, because of the widespread belief in the threat from the West, the film's narrative plants the seed in viewers that vigilance was essential, and that, among other things, the construction of the Berlin Wall was necessary to protect the citizenry. This film's message follows a more alarmist narrative than what we typically find in the discourse about the construction of the wall that focuses on the bleeding of the population or protecting the citizens of East Berlin from the attractions of capitalism. Indeed, as Stöve suggests, For Eyes Only was also the precisely calibrated political endpoint of a chain of evidence against Western liberation policies that the GDR had been developing since 1958. Above all, the purpose of the film was, once and for all, to justify, in the eyes of the East German citizens, the construction of a wall that would cut off the GDR. By portraying the West's liberation policy as a very real threat, the film also sought to project an overall positive image of the Stasi. The Ministry for State Security saw an opportunity to optimally represent its operations to the public and to polish its public images. For Eyes Only thus also became an advertising vehicle for the MFS. The positive character traits that Hansen exhibits were designed to project the nature of the Stasi's work as based on humanistic tenets. His personal sacrifices were portrayed as necessary for the continued existence of the socialist state. After its release, the film was heralded for its realistic portrayals. Moreover, the film, along with the cast and crew, received awards, including the Merit Medal of the National People's Army in silver for Harry Türk, author of the screenplay, and for the actors Alfred Müller, Hansen, and Helmut Schreiber, Collins. Türk received his medal personally from Stasi chief Erich Mielke. While the positive reception in the East may come as no surprise, even Western media praised the film as a DEFA achievement, with the Frankfurter Rundschau declaring it the most attractive example of a DEFA film for that year. Like For Eyes Only, Chiffriert an Chef immediately immerses the viewer in the world of foreign espionage. The opening sequences show video and still images of the main character Wolf Brandin and his family spanning the period from June 1959 through April 1960. A non-diegetic narrator comments on these surveillance images of Number 5 for an unnamed boss. The audience quickly learns that the CIA is aware that Brandin, an electronics student in the GDR, works with classified information, and the CIA agent, Dr. Baum, is tasked with contacting him. This sets a series of events in motion, about which Brandin seems very naive. His status as a university student prohibits travel to the West, but this does not prevent him from traveling to West Berlin to visit his Aunt Caroline, who regularly procures a medicinal salve for his father, her brother. During that visit, Brandin encounters a man named Wagner, who pays him for answering banal questions about life in the GDR, such as the price of butter and the availability of razor blades. Wagner informs Brandin that he is willing to pay him for such information and gives him a slip of paper with an address where they are to meet. This is Brandin's first contact with a Western agent, and he does not fully realize that it is an attempt to recruit him for the West. Brandin reports the encounter to the Stasi. This important information occurs off-screen, and viewers only understand it based on the conversation between Brandin and Werner, the Stasi agent who remains his contact throughout the assignment. Werner interrogates Brandin about his visit to the West, whether he has discussed his report to the Stasi with anyone, and about his motives. When Werner is satisfied that Brandin has answered honestly, the interrogation ends, and Vanna's tone and demeanor change from a gruff and distanced interrogator to a convivial and sympathetic mentor. He proposes that they speak to each other with the informal du and makes tea for them. Vanna encourages Brandine to meet with Wagner. Brandine agrees, and Wagner leads him to the West Berlin Aquarium, where CIA agent Baum awaits him. Baum uses coercion tactics to convince Brandine to cooperate with the CIA, including showing him pictures of himself in the West, along with a recording of a conversation. He even tries to ply Brandine with alcohol and women, though the East German shows little interest. Baum informs him, "We appreciate talent and expertise," and promises Brandine an American passport if he performs well. He then undergoes rigorous training with Baum, who instructs him in discharging a weapon, using martial arts techniques, and decoding encrypted messages. He also learns how to tap into communications lines. Through regular meetings with Vanna, Brandine keeps the Stasi informed of his activities. These meetings are essential, for it is through his fatherly demeanor that Vanna is able to encourage Brandine to continue his covert activities. Living a double life takes a toll on Brandine, as he neglects his thesis, his wife Renate, and his daughter. Whereas Renate suspects that he is having an affair, she has no idea of the real reason for his petulance and exhaustion. In a sign of benevolence, Vanna discloses Brandine's secret life to Renate after the death of Brandine's father. Over time, the CIA agent Baum becomes a sympathetic figure, who displays great concern for Brandine's well-being. He devises an emergency means of communication to connect with Brandine that he classifies as private. As tensions between the two German states intensify, Baum's boss wants information at all costs, and using the emergency communication route communicated to Brandine earlier, Baum schedules a meeting at the Olympic Stadium. There, Baum informs him, "The meeting is solely my responsibility. We are here privately." He informs Brandine of West Germany's plan to reprivatize the East and to cancel trade agreements. He further tells Brandine that headquarters is extremely pleased with his performance thus far. Believing in his loyalty, Baum instructs Brandine to tap into the underwater communications cable. Because Brandine has informed Vanna of the West's plans every step of the way, the East is ready with a ruse. The East intentionally transmits an unencoded message, followed immediately by the encoded one. This enables the West to decipher the code. The West falsely believes that circumstances in East Berlin are calm and that there is no reason to worry about the increased troop movements that have been observed. However, the opposite is true. The GDR has closed the border between East and West Berlin. The construction of the Berlin Wall thus comes as a total surprise to the West. The film's closing sequence shows Brandine and Renate in their apartment, where she says, "Now we can live like everyone else here." Following the successful completion of his mission, Brandine can look forward to a peaceful family life. The film draws heavily on the political context of the early 1960s, incorporating television and radio broadcasts that reflect the heightened tensions of the time. These broadcasts serve to remind viewers of the very real threats that the GDR faced then. Brandine sees a broadcast of Khrushchev's speech warning that peace is in danger. Similarly, a radio report from April 1960 draws attention to the importance of the upcoming Paris summit, which was convened to discuss the situation of divided Germany, the possibility of arms control, and the relaxation of tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union. A report a few months later reveals details about the trial of Gary Francis Powers, a U.S. pilot captured by the Soviet Union while spying. Likewise, video footage of the atomic bomb attack on Hiroshima, known to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the bombing, underscores the fragility of peace. These all serve as reminders not just that threats to the GDR were real, but also that it is necessary to maintain high levels of vigilance and security with regard to enemies of the state. Thus, audience members can revel in the fact that the Berlin Wall has protected them from such threats in the ensuing 18 years and that it will continue to do so. In Chiffriert an Chef, the stereotyping of Western agents is not as crass as in Four Eyes Only. The CIA agent Dr. Baum is a philologist trained in German. While he initially is portrayed as arrogant about his intelligence, to which his superior responds, "Being too clever is not good," his character softens over time. He is straightforward with Brandine about the dangers of the mission. And as he watches from the western shore as Brandine attempts to tap into the communications cable, he appears genuinely concerned for his well-being. Baum's superior, on the other hand, is portrayed as more callous, focusing on the mission rather than the human cost. This is depicted most egregiously in a scene where he dines on an extravagant meal of fish, while imploring Baum to put Brandine to use. Because the film takes place primarily in the East, it is also logical that it focuses more on Brandine and his relationships. It emphasizes a positive and sanitized image of the Stasi, evoked by Werner's compassion and benevolence, which stands in stark contrast to the more calculated nature of the Western spies. Approximately the same age as Brandine's father, Werner assumes a caretaker role in his life. When Brandine's double life begins to take a toll on his personal life, Werner, as the only one who knows what is really going on, makes him tea, offers him a place to take a nap, and consoles him when his father dies. Werner, as emblematic for the Stasi, is never portrayed in a negative light. In his interactions with Brandine, he always presents a cool head. Conversely, in the West, Brandine is actively schooled in espionage, including armed hand-to-hand combat. Such contrasts position the East as a defender of peace, whereas the West is portrayed as actively seeking violent conflict. It is not surprising that comparisons of Four Eyes Only and Chiffriert an Chef can be made, since the two films have multiple plot elements in common. In both films, the double agents, Hansen and Brandine, are positive figures who engage in espionage activities to protect their way of life in the GDR. Though both of their private lives suffer as a result of their leading a double life, their experiences are temporary and portrayed as a necessary evil. While Hansen was already employed at MID, Chiffriert an Chef explores the CIA's covert recruitment of Brandine. The characterization of Western agents draws on stereotypes of unscrupulousness, womanizing, a razor focus on violence and war, and questionable Nazi backgrounds, whereas the Stasi agents are sympathetic and patriotic figures who exhibit a fatherly compassion for their agents. In both films, the main characters are subjected to lie detector tests in the West as a means to determine their loyalty. These tests are both physically and psychologically grueling. In the East, by contrast, loyalty is a given. Even in the case of Brandine, his initial interrogation with Werner occurs in Werner's apartment without the need for machinery. The lie detector tests underscore the suspicious nature of the Western espionage agencies and the lengths to which they will go to determine loyalty. Such extremes contrast openly with the more benevolent treatment that the Stasi handlers portray. Ultimately, both Hansen and Brandine betray their Western handlers, which permits the reconciliation of the agents with their families. Moreover, there is a cinematic connection in Alfred Müller. The actor who plays Hansen makes a cameo appearance as Werner's superior. These films are unapologetic about their positive portrayals of the Stasi. Hansen and Brandine participate willingly in the spy games, and the Stasi is represented as a necessary tool in the fight to maintain the GDR's preferred socialist way of life as an alternative to the imperialist and fascist West. Moreover, they depict the Stasi exclusively as an essential component of national security, with its view fixated totally on threats from the outside. In other words, these films do not reveal any of the intrigue that we have come to expect from the shadow world of unofficial operatives, as presented in high-grossing films such as The Lives of Others, Henkel von Donnersmarck, 2006. Because these films also serve to portray the Stasi in a positive light, viewers are presented with reconnaissance not as something that violates the private sphere, but rather as something that is necessary to defend their way of life. The Stasi stepped up its domestic surveillance following the suppression of the Prague Spring Uprising and continued to increase it throughout the 1970s. Thus, the emphasis on foreign espionage in Chiffriert en Chef deflects the negative perception of Stasi scrutiny as an invasion of the private sphere by redirecting the image to the Stasi as a necessary reinforcement of state security. By refocusing audience attention on the early 1960s and away from the upheaval of the late 1970s that occurred following the expatriation of Biermann, the director Juba is able to recast the Stasi as a key component in protecting GDR citizens from external threats. Moreover, the conclusion of Chiffriert en Chef alludes to the fact that Brandine's affiliation with the Stasi was a temporary task, and upon completion, he and his family will return to their normal lives. Again, this message deflects the idea that the Stasi is all-pervasive and omnipresent. The film arouses the viewer's empathy, precisely because the focus is on protecting the GDR from the foreign enemy and reminding the audience that external threats are still real. Indeed, it is significant that both films portray the threat as coming from the United States, not the Federal Republic. A clear sign that imperialism was to be associated with the Western Allies, who exerted considerable influence over the Federal Republic. Unlike actual Stasi spies, such as Heinz Bavik, neither Hansen nor Brandine spied to defect, but instead to help the GDR. In both of these DEFA films, the Stasi agents do not conform to the surreptitious images that we have become accustomed to in Western spy films. Indeed, the Stasi was actively involved in the character portrayals in Four Eyes Only. Dramaturg Dieter Wolf explains, for instance, that the Stasi objected to the initial characterization of the Stasi colonel and two colleagues at the headquarters in East Berlin. Whereas director Weitsche cast the actors to emphasize their proletarian nature, the Stasi wanted them to exude a stronger intellectual aura. In essence, characterizing the agents occupied with Western espionage as the elite among agents, similar to Bond. As a result, this sequence had to be reshot, even though the set had been dismantled. Wolf states that this type of change was very unusual and was meant to strengthen how the representatives of the Stasi appeared in comparison to the opposing side. Thus, the Stasi was keen on crafting the particular image of a patriotic hero, one who focuses on family values, unlike the sex and glamour-obsessed Bond figure. Whereas the depiction of an external threat in Four Eyes Only derived from a carefully orchestrated marketing campaign designed to convince the GDR populace that a threat from the West was imminent, the situation in 1979 was much different. Though the wall's stability assuaged fears of invasion, new threats emerged from internal dissidents. Moreover, the signing of the Helsinki Final Act in 1975 opened the GDR to international scrutiny regarding human rights violations. the return to threats from the 1960s in Chiffriert an Chef appears to be an attempt to deflect attention from these later developments. Fundamentally, then, these films serve to affirm the GDR's decision to close the German-German border, and they cement an alternative narrative as justification. Rather than addressing the economic crisis that the flight of the populace posed, these films assert that the U.S. liberation policy and the fear of some kind of impending Western overthrow were the formal justification for the construction of the Berlin Wall. Indeed, three additional feature films premiered in 1962 and 1963 that also focused on Western plots as a valid justification for the construction of the wall. Und Deine Liebe auch, and Your Love Too, Vogel, 1962, Der Kinnhaken, The Uppercut, Thiel, 1962, Der Sonntagsfahrer, The Sunday Driver, Klein, 1963. All three met with limited success. In the end, only For Eyes Only is remembered as a successful example of the spy film genre in East German film history.